You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Anthony Richter. I'd like to. I'm the associate director of the Open Society Institute. I'm also director of our program on Middle East and North Africa here. I'd like to welcome everybody to tonight's open forum on the Iraqi refugee crisis, bearing witness. The Open Society Institute has been involved with Iraq for quite a number of years. When shortly after the invasion, the Open Society Institute launched an Iraq Revenue Watch, which has been conducting monitoring and subsequently assistance to civil society in keeping track of the money that the Iraqi government earns from its oil revenues. And subsequently, as the crisis has worn on, we've become more and more involved on the subject of this evening's event, Iraqi refugees. We have been assisting the Scholar Rescue Fund, which is settling scholars from Iraq in Arab universities. We have been providing support to the Refugees International, whose Christelle Yunus will be speaking here tonight. And we've been looking for ways to engage with youth and women in the large diaspora refugee populations in Syria and Jordan. And I was there with a team of colleagues from OSI just in December. Before I introduce the panelists, I just want to read some technical announcements so that you'll know what to do when the program gets going. First of all the panelists are asked to speak loudly and into the microphone at all times. When the time for question and answer comes, you can queue up in front of the mic there and ask your questions again into the mic. And the reason for the all these miking directions is that this event is being recorded for subsequent broadcast on our website, www.soros.org, and therefore we need to have good high-fidelity recording. Finally, there's an emergency exit this way in the unlikely event that you will need it in the next 2 hours. I'm going to try and run the program in such a way as to actually finish at 7:45, and then after that, you're invited to stay here and drink and schmooze until 8 o'clock, and then we'll kick you out. So the order of speakers is actually, it works out to be the order in which people are presented here. I'd just like to say a couple of words about our illustrious panel. I'm really delighted we have so many people who share our concern about the scale of the Iraqi refugee crisis and have put so much of their personal efforts into documenting it, especially in a situation where much of the public in the United States seems to prefer that they would like not to see or hear or think about this very sizable population of refugees. So we're going to begin with Lori Grinker, award-winning photographer and who's a faculty member of the International Center for Photography. She has a new exhibition called Life Interrupted, the Iraqi Refugee Crisis at the Nayibia Alexander Gallery, and she's also the author of a book called After War, which we've been part of a group tour that we've been traveling in the Middle East. So she will show her film. Then we're going to hear from Dr. Omar Saleh Mahdi, who's an Iraqi doctor, journalist, and documentary film director, whose Emmy Award-winning Baghdad Hospital Inside the Red Zone will be premiering on HBO on January 29th. And he's going to speak a little bit about his personal experiences and those of his family as Iraqis. Next, we're extremely fortunate to have here George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate, and also the author of a new play, Betrayed, based on the eponymous article from The New Yorker of about just a year ago, and he's going to speak to this subject of Iraqi refugees and talk a little bit about the opening of his play. And then finally, Christelle Yunus, who's an advocate leading the work at Refugees International, which is probably the foremost group doing advocacy on refugees here in the United States, and she's been spearheading their effort, which has been extremely influential in shaping policy both in the U.S. and internationally, and the international response on Iraqi refugees. And she will give us the facts, the figures, the call to action that will be the jumping off point for our discussion. So without further ado, Laurie Grinker, just say a word and introduce your film.
I really can only say one word. Since we're starting late, I'm not going to say much, except that all of this was shot in Amman.
Thank you very much for everybody who came here tonight, and thank you so much for the footage that usually rare to be seen, because there's more than 4 million Iraqi displaced from their houses. 2 million are outside Iraq and 2 million inside Iraq, and maybe the accurate figure are much higher. So it's very rare to see or to listen to those people speak. I'm gonna tell you my personal account of what have happened to my family, because I'm representing one. My story is like million of other people's stories. We all share the fear and the persecution that we've been exposed to from the militias, the gangs, the insurgents that's controlling our country now. My older brother was kidnapped last on November 2006. He's been taken because of his sect by militia. He was with other 7 men. They took him to a nearby mosque and they tortured them, and they shot everybody in the head just simply because it's very easy for their to kill anybody. My brother survived. He was the only one who survived from the other, and they dumped the body and they transferred them to a nearby hospital by a truck belonged to the Iraqi army. One of the Iraqi army members saw my brother still alive, so instead of helping him, he shot him in the eye, and he lost his right eye. Because he told him that now let's see how you're gonna survive. Now you are, because he believes he was insurgents, and that was, and he should be killed. My brother survived, but he had to leave his house with his family. He has a wife and 2 kids, and we thought that if we remain in hide, that we'll be fine to live. And 2 months later, in last January, my 2 younger brothers were kidnapped while they were coming back home from school. They were taken by insurgents, and they were they beat them, and they were interrogating them, and they asked the older one, who is 17, to go to the street and bring a taxi driver who's a Shia, and in case they killed him, they will release both of them. We connected some people, and we get them back, but they've been really in a bad experience, so we had to hide them, and we thought that we can go living in hide till last June. Also, a group of militia, they took my father, and we tried also to get in touch with them and to rescue him, but he just disappeared. We tried to contact everybody there from those militias or those people who believe they've took him, but unfortunately we didn't hear anything. A week later, I find his body in Baghdad morgue. It was a really painful moment to be in the morgue, not because I was looking for my father's body, but because of the horrible scene there. There were hundreds of bodies, and I'm not exaggerating. They were filling all the hallway because there's no enough or good equipped fridge to accommodate all those bodies. So killing in Iraq is very easy. People are persecuted for simple things, not only because they are working or involving with the American, which is the great sin that being happen in Iraq if you are working with a foreigner, but also if you are belong to a certain sect or if you are in a wrong place, it's just simply that they can kill you. So that's my story, and I'm aware that a lot of people have maybe more extreme story than I have. I don't know in Iraq anybody, all my friends, all the people I know in Iraq have the same things. Most of them, they lost somebody or they've been targeted by some kind of violence. Anyway, after that I moved my family to Syria, and they are struggling there to survive, and we had a really difficult time getting my brothers back to school there, and they are filed for the UNHCR, and their interview is the next month. We still hoping that they find a solution for them. My family are living in Syria now, and in their street there are another four Iraqi families who are families of my friends in Baghdad. They are living there also because either they've been targeted or they escaped fearing to be persecuted or to have somebody killed. The thing is that Iraqi refugees are really in very bad situation. They don't have money. They are unable to work in Syria or in Jordan. Also, Jordan and Syria, Jordan closed the door completely in face of Iraqis, and Syria now are putting strict rules to for any Iraqi who wants to go there. They need visa to go there, and also they need to have certain condition in order to get a residency there, and this residency are reviewed every 3 months to see if they can stay there or they will ask them to leave. It's very, and there's also a lot of people who went back to Iraq because they ran out their money. They just don't have any much more money to live in Syria, and also they were unable to get their kids to school, so they prefer to go back, hoping that situation are improving there. But like the reality in Iraq, things are not improving. I mean, just last week I've been talking to a friend of mine, and he told me that a friend that we know, he was shot in the street. The killing are still there, and last night I think you heard that there were a huge explosion in the north of Iraq. The thing is that there's a group of gangs of people who are very coward to face each other, so they are targeting the civilians in a horrible way, trying to send message to each other, and it's only those civilians, the innocent people who get caught in this ugly war, who are hopeless and in a very desperate situation. And I'm very glad to be here and to see so much people here care about that, because I'm hoping you will be able to make some change or to improve the situation of Iraqi refugees. Thank you very much.
George?
Well, first of all, thank you all for coming. It shows that some people do care about an issue that's struggled to claim the attention of the American public and the world. I'm very glad Omar is here. He is one of my dearest friends, and we work together extensively in Iraq. And I mean, Omar belongs to a generation of Iraqis, young Iraqis, who saw the arrival of the Americans in 2003 as a chance to come out of the prison that was Iraq under Saddam and have the hope of connections to the world, travel, education, and personal freedom. And the story that Omar just told you is one little microcosm of the story of that whole generation, which over the last almost 5 years has seen those hopes slowly but surely destroyed by a combination of American incompetence and indifference and the viciousness of Iraqi militias and insurgent groups and the selfishness of Iraqi politicians. So there are many authors of this disaster, but it's for me particularly, it's Iraqis like Omar who bring home what's tragic about it in a very personal way. We all know stories of people killed for being of the wrong group in the wrong neighborhood. It happened in the Balkans. It happened in West Africa. It's happening in Congo. It happened in Southeast Asia. It's not a new story. But what is new in Iraq, or relatively new for us as Americans, is this was a direct result of the invasion. Iraq was a prison, but it was a prison in which people could survive if they kept their heads down. And now Iraq is a killing field. And what is remarkable to me is that this enormous refugee population, which is directly a result of the war, has not become an important issue in America. It's almost been a hidden issue until recently, and some advocacy and congressional and media attention has put a light on it, but it remains basically an ignored humanitarian disaster that is at our doorstep. It is our responsibility. And the fact that it doesn't come up in every single debate that the candidates have to sit through in the course of the campaign shows, I think, a failure of the press and a failure of the politicians to face it. We hear on one side that we're winning, and the implication is, therefore, those refugees should be going home now and resuming their lives. As Omar just told you, that's not the way it is in Iraq. The improvements are marginal, and beneath the improvements lies great fear and lawlessness. On the other side, we hear that we've done all we can and we should go home as quickly as possible. No word about what to do about this gigantic humanitarian crisis left behind in our wake. So one thing that I hope comes out of tonight is everyone in this room begins to, in whatever way you can, demand that anyone who wants to be president next year should have to answer questions about what he or she will do to address this issue. And it's unfortunate that Tim Russert and Brian Williams don't ask them that, but somehow they must be asked and they must be made to think about it, because it is our responsibility as Americans. I went back for my sixth trip, I think, to Baghdad last January and saw Omar, and we had a long, long conversation in which I heard his whole experience of the war. And I did this over and over with a particular category of Iraqis, basically young people who, in one way or another, stuck their necks out to work with the foreigners who came to their country, whether it's the American government and military or journalists or NGOs. And the story was the same in every case. And I must have talked to 36 Iraqis or more in Baghdad, in Kurdistan, in Damascus, in Amman, even in Malmo, Sweden, because the Swedes have taken in over 20,000 Iraqis, which is a deep irony since they were not part of the coalition of the willing. And the story was the same. And the story was high hopes, gradually, very reluctantly, but inevitably, destroyed and replaced by a sense of being hunted and of having to hide and assume false identities and tell lies to family and friends about what they were doing, and to change the names in their cell phones, and to never speak English on the street, and to slip in and out of the green zone as inconspicuously as possible, and find different routes to and from work every day. It was a stalked and hunted group of Iraqis that I found myself talking to, getting death threats, getting phone calls from strangers that were, you know, were threatening, and finally, in some cases, leaving the country. But the recurring theme over and over was whenever they reached out to their American employers or supervisors for help, they got essentially a shrug. This was a bureaucratic nuisance. And when I went to the embassy in Baghdad and asked the relevant questions to the number two at the embassy and to other officials, I've never felt quite so ashamed to be an American in my life. And I've been going to Iraq for many years, and this shame never quite hit me because I met a lot of good Americans in Iraq. But in this case, their answers were pathetic. They didn't even try really to put up a good front because they had nothing to say for themselves. Why didn't you raise the security clearance of these Iraqis from yellow to green so that they could avoid the long lines at the green zone gates and be searched inside and therefore not be spotted by the informers and lookouts who wait outside the green zone looking for people who are going into work? We couldn't do it for all of them, so we didn't do it for any of them. These were the kinds of answers I got. And I came home and wrote up a story for the New Yorker magazine that I hope had the full force of the anger and shame I felt, because it was, there is no reason for this except politics. It's not as though I was asking them to stabilize Iraq or to solve its political problems or to even solve the refugee crisis. All I was saying was, why don't you take responsibility for the Iraqis who work for you, who trusted you, who risked their lives for you? Very small, easily identified, easily solved problem. And the answers were utterly unsatisfying. And they remain unsatisfying. And this is the maddening thing about this issue, this particular piece of the refugee issue. It's been written about, it's been spoken about, Congress has passed legislation, refugee advocates have issued reports and lobbied Capitol Hill, and yet, month after month, the number of Iraqis getting into this country is diminishing. And Christelle can give you those numbers. Month after month, I hear anecdotally of this or that Iraqi who worked for Americans who got in, but as a group, the door remains shut in their faces. Month after month, I'm waiting for the president to say something about this issue. Just, we have a moral obligation, I agree. Not one word, not one syllable uttered by the president about this issue. Gerald Ford, at the end of the Vietnam War, said, "We must allow the Vietnamese who were our friends to come here. To do less would add moral shame to humiliation." That was political courage. But what we see in Washington now is political cowardice, because to bring Iraqis here because they can't survive in their own country because of their association with us is not a good story. It's a story of essentially a failure. Maybe not the failure, but a failure. And so, because, as with every other aspect of this war, it has been run essentially from a public relations viewpoint, we're not letting them in. And they're continuing to hide, to run, to become refugees, to see their savings dwindle to nothing in the streets of Damascus or Amman. And I have begun to wonder whether anything will change that. I mean, I spoke to a veterans group a week or two ago and said, maybe you guys are the only ones who can do this because you have the bona fides of being Iraq veterans. They all cared about the issue. They all had interpreters who they're worried about. I said, you should go in your civilian clothes to the gates of the White House and hold up a great big banner, call a press conference, and hold up a banner that says, "Mr. President, save our Iraqi friends." It's sort of a soldier's code. You don't leave your friend on the battlefield. They all knew that. Maybe that's the only thing that will get attention. I don't know. Maybe we'll have to wait for the next president, but that's a year from now. So I'm actually quite frustrated about this. I wrote a play, as Anthony mentioned, based on that article, which is about to open here in New York, partly to draw attention to the issue, partly just because, as a writer, the stories I heard moved me so much that I wanted to give them some other form, some other voice. Because it really is the story of a tragedy, a human tragedy. And I'm frustrated. I don't know what more can be done by advocates and journalists, because everyone now knows about it. Nothing has changed. And with that, I'll see if Christelle has some more encouraging words for you.
Thank you. I'm frustrated too, so I'm not sure I can start on a joyful note, but basically to sort of widen the discussion to all Iraqis. Alma mentioned earlier that there are now more than 4 million Iraqis who are displaced in and outside of their country. 2.4 million are now displaced internally, and those who are displaced internally are finding it increasingly difficult to find a safe shelter. 11 out of Iraq's 18 governorates have shut their internal borders, and people have nowhere left to go. They have no place to run. And so we don't even know where displacement starts and ends in Iraq, because people want to leave but have nowhere to go to. As for the rest of the region, there are now 2.5 million Iraqi refugees in Syria, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Turkey, in Iran, and most of these countries have also shut their borders. So again, people have nowhere left to go. This is clearly one of the largest displacement crises in the world, certainly the largest the Middle East has ever seen. People refer to it as the largest since the Palestinian exodus, but this is actually much larger than the Palestinian crisis was in 1948 and in 1967, and 60 years later, we're still dealing with the aftermath of the Palestinian situation. One can only hope that the Iraqi crisis is not going to turn out to be another protracted crisis the Middle East will have to deal with. In terms of who is fleeing, obviously those who have worked with Americans or foreign foreigners inside Iraq, but pretty much anybody is at risk in today's Iraq. And this is really what is most concerning. There's nowhere safe. There's nobody who's safe. Scholars have been targeted, doctors, journalists, architects, hairdressers, for crying out loud. I met a hairdresser in Damascus whose job was deemed un-Islamist by some militias, and she had to run for her life. Anybody can be targeted, a Sunni in a Shia area, a Shia in a Sunni area, a Christian, a Mandaean, a Sabaean. There's nobody is safe anymore. And so it makes it extremely difficult for aid organizations like us to really determine who the most vulnerable people are, because everybody is vulnerable at this stage. As I mentioned, the borders are now pretty much closed. Syria was the last sort of open place for Iraqis to go to. And in October, after the Iraqi government asked Syria to do so, Syria closed its borders. The Iraqi government felt that it was no longer warranted for its people to leave, and they felt that it looked bad for Iraqis to go elsewhere. So they asked the Syrian government to close the borders, and so they did. And now it's become nearly impossible for Iraqis to go to Syria unless they're part of specific professions. It has basically severely limited the right to asylum inside Syria. The humanitarian situation in the countries of asylum is extremely dire. Syria, in the course of 3 years, has absorbed 1.5 million Iraqis. Syria is not a very rich country. It's a country with very high unemployment rate, with a highly subsidized economy. And the fact that there's now an extra 1.5 million people who are impoverished, who are traumatized, and who are living mostly in the poor neighborhoods of Damascus is having a very, very strong effect on the country's infrastructure. The same can be said of Jordan. Lebanon, of course, has its own set of problems, and 50,000 Iraqi refugees are adding to the mix, and obviously the Lebanese are not seeing this with a very keen eye. Similarly, Egypt has one of the highest unemployment rates in the Middle East. One Egyptian out of three is living under the poverty line. Add to this an extra 150,000 Iraqis. You're starting to see the picture. The systems are completely overburdened, the healthcare facilities are overburdened, schools are overburdened, and it's a minority of Iraqi children now who are going to school. It's less than 10% of Iraqi refugee children who are going to school. This used to be one of the most educated populations in the Middle East, and now it's an entire generation of children who's going to go uneducated if we don't react very, very quickly. The countries that are hosting Iraqis, except for Egypt, are not signatory to the Refugee Convention. They don't recognize the refugee status. Therefore, Iraqis are guests, neighbors, tourists, but can be basically kicked out at any moment. And that, of course, has severe effect on the way they live inside those countries. They cannot work, they cannot access the public services most of the time, and they live in a constant state of anxiety at the idea of being pushed back, of being forced back. And recently, and I'm extremely frustrated because the administration has basically milked the story for everything it had, but basically recently about 30,000 Iraqi families returned to Iraq, and this was you know, advertise as a big success, the surge is working, people want to return, etc. Well, no, people don't want to return, but they can't survive in the countries of first asylum. They don't have any money left, they can't send their children to school, nobody's there to help them, and plus the Iraqi government, who is unable to provide any help to the displaced, is actually giving money to encourage people to go back, because again, it looks good for people to return. The UN has come out and said that in no way was this return safe return, and in no way should it be encouraged. And thankfully now the Iraqi government has stepped back from its policy, but still it's had its effect. And unfortunately, I think the U.S. public has been led to believe that the situation was much better because people were returning. The ones who are displaced inside Iraq are obviously in not no better situation. The humanitarian criteria, the humanitarian standards that are used by aid organizations to establish the level of life of civilians in a given country are at an all-time low inside Iraq. The malnutrition rates are off the roof. There were cases of cholera in a developed country, in a country that never had illnesses like this before. And we see a complete situation of Balkanization. Sunnis in Sunni areas, Shia in Shia areas, minorities that have basically nowhere left to go. And what has been portrayed as a huge success of the surge is actually a result of this Balkanization. Militias now control particular areas. No other groups are going into these areas, and therefore perhaps the incidents of violence have lessened, but de facto the country is no safer than it used to be. There are huge property issues, and there will be huge property issues with any sort of return phenomenon. Most people who have left their houses behind. Those houses were occupied by people who moved into those neighborhoods. And the same way we saw this happen through the Balkans during the 90s, we're going to see it happening inside Iraq. People are going to come back, and they're not going to be able to reclaim their houses. And right now, there are no systems inside Iraq to really facilitate a return. There, another disaster really is there is in Iraq a public distribution of food system that was instituted during the sanctions, whereby every Iraqi family would receive a food package every month. This was a very, very efficient system. And when the U.S. came into Iraq, the system was so efficient that they decided to use this as the basis of the voter registration system. So a system that was initially purely humanitarian became highly politicized. And now when people are moving inside Iraq, they're finding it almost impossible to transfer their food ration cards because it means transferring their voting rights as well. So most of the people who have been displaced don't have access to the food distribution system anymore. Obviously, another huge issue inside the country is the lack of humanitarian access. And that also is a huge cause of frustration for me. Obviously, the security situation is very bad. But since the very beginning of the war, the coalition forces have adopted a strategy of confusing, of blurring the lines between the military and the civilian efforts inside Iraq. Humanitarian agencies were encouraged to work with the U.S. Army the way they were encouraged in Afghanistan. Provincial reconstruction teams were instituted where, you know, the army was basically delivering assistance, and therefore it has become extremely difficult for the ordinary Iraqi to make the difference between a real humanitarian agency and a coalition effort, and that has further impeded access. I just want to touch a little bit about the regional implications of this war, because this is one of the messages we're trying to drive to Washington, and that I really wish could be heard. This administration, like many others, doesn't seem to respond unless there's a massive crisis, and they don't seem to acknowledge the fact that the crisis is already there. We hear a lot of Republicans right now say that if the U.S. withdraws, there will be a huge humanitarian crisis. Well, there is a huge humanitarian crisis. We hear a lot of Democrats say that, you know, the U.S. should withdraw because the situation is so bad anyway. But there is absolutely no talk about, first of all, Iraqi civilians. And frankly, the obligations that the U.S. has is not just towards its former employees. It's not just towards the Iraqi government. It's towards Iraqi civilians. We never hear about them in public debates. And we never hear about the effect that this massive crisis is having on the entire Middle East. again, this is not Sweden. It's one of the most volatile regions in the world. Even in Sweden, you know, if you had 5 million people moving there in the course of 3 years, you would have destabilization. In the Middle East, added to the existing sectarian tensions, the existing political tensions, and the fact that, frankly, Middle Eastern countries are fed up of having to deal with messes that they have not caused, of, frankly, being fed up of having to deal with a protracted crisis, the Palestinian one, that has seen no international solution in 60 years, this is creating a lot of resentment and a lot of tensions in the region. And it is becoming a serious, serious security issue. If for no other reason, the U.S. government needs to act. Obviously, we would like the U.S. government to act out of the goodness of its heart, but if it's not going to do so, it should do it because it's in own interest to do so. To have a further unstable Middle East is certainly not in the interest of this country. Just to touch upon a little bit the U.S. and the international response, a year ago, George and I were testifying before Congress, and I think I said at the time that the response was abysmal. Unfortunately, I'd still say the same today. The response is abysmal, and it's almost a joke. I mean, really, when you talk about resettlement, and when you see that, as George mentioned, after the Vietnam War, in the course of 9 months, Gerald Ford resettled 131,000 Vietnamese into this country. There were no computers. And it was 9 months, and there was the political will to do so, and there was certainly a sense of obligation. Last year, in 2007, the U.S. government pledged to resettle 7,000 people. It only managed to resettle about 1,600. In 2008, the U.S. government is pledging to resettle 12,000 Iraqis. Again, the numbers are very low. Right now, we're seeing about 200-300 a month coming through. There is no excuse for that. The reason is a lack of political will, and it's a lack of leadership. If the president and if Secretary Rice were taking this seriously, we would see movement. They're not taking this seriously just yet. In terms of assistance, the levels are also abysmal. You know, the State Department is constantly advertising that it spent $200 million responding to the crisis in 2007. $200 million is less than the cost of one day of the war. The message it's sending to the region, the message it's sending to Iraqis, is that it simply doesn't care. And this message is being heard loud and clear by the region and by Iraqis. And it's going to have consequences, not only for the credibility of the United States, but also for its security, frankly. I would like to end on a positive note because this is all so depressing. But I think there are ways forward, and otherwise, you know, we just all go kill ourselves. But there's advocacy to continue to be done. Certainly, resettlement is one component of it. We need to put pressure on the U.S. government to welcome into this country not only the people who have worked for the U.S., but also those who are so vulnerable that they cannot survive in the region. When I was in Egypt, I met with a family. The father was catatonic when I met with the family, and I asked the mother what had happened. And she said that their 5-year-old son had been kidnapped inside Iraq and that they were asked to pay a ransom. And they paid the ransom, and the son was killed anyway. And not only was he killed, but his body was sent back to the family cooked with rice on a plate. And their case was referred for resettlement and was not deemed acceptable by the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. It simply was not vulnerable enough. Clearly, there's something wrong with the system. If people like that are not afforded international protection, there's something wrong with the system. We need much more political engagement on the part of the U.S. Obviously, Syria is not a friend, but it is welcoming 1.5 million civilians that are of great interest to the United States. There should be high-level discussions about the fate of these civilians. We need to see much more assistance going into the region, not just to the UN, but bilateral assistance. Those countries have had their systems severely hit by this crisis, and they need help. In 2003, Jordan was awarded $700 million as a friend to make up for the potential blow of the war. 4 years later, the blow is there, this money is nowhere to be seen. We need to see much more of that. We need to see engagement with the Arab League. I was in Cairo a couple of months ago, met with the Secretary General of the Arab League. He said he never was contacted by the U.S. government about this issue. Again, unacceptable. This is a regional mechanism. They need to be involved. We need just simply much more awareness. As George said, this needs to be a forefront issue in any political debate in this country. This has to be a bipartisan issue. It's not whether you're for or against the war. It's really a matter of moral decency at this time. And whether the U.S. withdraws or not, its obligation towards Iraqi civilians remains the same. Thank you.
You've had a number of powerful and actually very difficult statements here, and I'd like to open the floor. But I was wondering, you know, Laurie, obviously it was difficult to watch that, and it was it must have been difficult to make. What's happened to some of the people that you photographed?
Fatin, the first woman who spoke, that family, they're still there. She's there with 21 members of her family. She and her sister are both about to have babies in exile. And they work very, very hard going to the UNHCR every day, applying for visas. They've been turned down 3 times for the USA, and she thinks it's something to do with the translation of some of the documents she sent, so she's trying to rectify that. They're working now under the table. They're working. Her husband's working in a sandal factory, and she helps stitch the sandals. And they make, you know, just the bare minimum to try to get food on the table. They buy old vegetables from the grocer in order to be able to feed their family. The second woman with heart disease. All the kids are in school now, but they're still there. They have no movement as far as being resettled. Fadi, whose brother was killed, he and his two brothers worked for the Americans. He got turned down for the U.S. and got into Australia. His other brother came here for medical treatment through some soldiers that he worked with and applied for asylum and got it. And that was when his brother was killed, and Fadi applied and got turned down. Fadi's in Australia with a really good job, with money to help him get resettled, being really well taken care of, and he's very happy, but he's so far away from his family. His mother and nephew just got accepted to the U.S. I don't know why he didn't. The woman who was crying just got accepted into Holland. And Furman, the translator, is still stuck in Amman, unable to work, and still very, very frustrated and panicked. You know, one thing about, like, Muna, her father is retired, and, you know, he was looking forward to traveling in Europe during his retirement. Now he's supporting a family of 10 people in Amman, and they're living in a 3-bedroom apartment. It's a nice middle-class apartment, but it's 10 people, and it's very difficult for him to get his pension from Iraq to Amman, and he's running out of his money. So that's it. That's his life now.
Okay. It's interesting that the person who did get here got asylum, because that's anecdotally jibes with what I've heard, which is becoming a refugee and getting admitted and getting resettled here is so hard. But if you can find a way here, and some Iraqis are literally crossing the Mexican border, mm-hmm. The chances are pretty good, because the asylum courts are somewhat insulated from politics still compared to the INS, and it's a little irony. If you can just somehow get across that border and you're an Iraqi, but yeah, it's a long way away.
Well, he got in because he was shot in the head, and
that's also the hard way.
And he's now, I just spoke to him the other day, Samir, his Fadi's brother, and he was hauling hot dog carts back to the garage when he first came here. Now he has a green card, and he's actually selling food from a hot dog cart. And he owned a perfume factory in Iraq.
I'd like to open the floor to questions, and if request to the questioners, if you just state your name and affiliation for the benefit of the audience and the speakers.
Sure. My name is Myrna Ajabi, and I work for the Open Society Justice Initiative. I'd like to push this point further on the reasons that you're able to determine on the refusal of asylum and refugee. Are you sensing a fear of the floodgates, that if you put the level of persecution at a certain level, that the numbers are so high. I'd also like to hear if you can comment on whether there's an underlying sense of contempt for all Iraqis and a fear in terms of Muslims from the Middle East as being a security threat, and also a bit of security backgrounds. I know that is pervasive in the immigration system, and the refusal and the unwillingness to accept those from the Middle East on that issue of being security threats, potentially.
Christelle, would you like to take
that? Well, they'll never say it out loud, but there certainly is a fear of the Muslim man in the immigration strategy that this administration is having right now. It's extremely difficult for any refugee to be resettled into the U.S., and it's actually the hardest way any foreigner can come into the U.S. And, you know, this is the argument we always bring forward to this administration, is that if anybody wants to come to this country to do harm, it's way, way easier to come as a tourist or as a businessman or on a work permit or a student visa. It's so complicated to go through the refugee resettlement process, because your story is checked and checked and checked by about 12 different levels of people, and, you know, the references are checked, everything is cross-checked, and it would be extremely difficult for anybody to fall through the cracks. And actually, as a matter of fact, it hasn't really happened yet. I think there are several issues. First of all, the lack of political will. There is a reluctance to admit that the situation in Iraq warrants a very large resettlement program. You know, in 2007, the United States resettled much more Iranians than it did Iraqis. It would be very difficult to argue that Iran is a closer friend than Iraq at this stage. The Department of Homeland Security is terrified that they would let somebody in who would end up being a problem. And without leadership coming from the top, without the president saying this is a priority for me and I want to extend the numbers, they're not going to be the ones going out on a limb and try to make it happen. So really, I think the main issue is a lack of political will. I think there definitely is a problem of perception of who Iraqis are and who the people who are fleeing are. Until we see much more coordination at a government level, it's not going to happen. We're still going to be seeing very small numbers. For now, the target is 12,000, but as I said earlier, if they continue going at this rate, they're never going to be making that target. They might reach 3,000, but they won't reach much higher.
Anything else on this one? Okay, sir.
I just want to thank you all for shedding some light on this very important issue. My name is Jose Vasquez. I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I wanted to address the issue that George raised in terms of the troops having an impact on this war. And so I am here to extend an invitation to all of you to an event that Iraq Veterans Against the War is organizing in D.C. March 13th to the 16th. It's called Winter Soldier. And basically we're going to have Iraq and Afghanistan veterans testifying to the atrocities that they've witnessed and participated in some cases. And we have a opening for a panel of Iraqi and Afghan civilians, and we want to also bring a live feed from Amman to bring this issue of the refugee crisis to the forefront. So we are very much interested in working with any of you folks, and I'll be around for that. And just thank you. Thank you very much for bringing attention to this.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am, please.
My name is Kate Kassa. I'm from the Lebanese American University in Beirut, and I have a couple of questions. One, what can academic institutions like ours do aside from scholarships for refugees that are already in the country? But the other thing is, where are the Gulf states on this? Is there any money? Is there any assistance? I mean, even if they're not accepting refugees, are they not helping financially?
And where is Iraq itself, with its pledges of financial support?
I can't give you the numbers. Maybe Christelle can. But I can tell you that among the people I've interviewed about this, the Gulf states are, if anything, in a kind of an active effort to thwart refugees from either coming into their borders or even getting legitimate jobs. I mean, I've heard stories of Iraqis offered jobs at universities in Dubai, in Yemen, and in the particular category that I've been talking about, the attitude is often, well, you let the Americans in and they got rid of Saddam and so we're not going to help you. I mean, these are considered bad Arabs, traitors to the Arab cause. So for that kind of racket, and Shia are often grouped in the same way because the Shia are considered to have welcomed the Americans. This is a problem in Arab country after country. It's not just that they're overwhelmed. It's that they, in many cases, are actively hostile to Iraqis because they, whether they blame them for the American war or whether they see them as the Shia specter rising with Iranian backing from the East, or whether they regard them as traitors who worked at the American embassy, for one reason or another, they're not wanted. And it's a given the wealth, given the fact that they have foreign workforces, the Gulf countries have been pathetic.
Absolutely, they have. It's interesting because in July, Syria went to the Arab League and asked for assistance to deal with the 1.5 million Iraqi refugees there, and they were basically told to go look elsewhere. The Arab League, and including the wealthier states, would not assist. The Emirates have recently given $10 million to UNHCR in Syria, and that's pretty much the extent of it. I'll just add a little something to what George said about the refusal of seeing Iraqis leave. I think there is a big fear of the Shia spectre, as he said, but there's also a reluctance of even seeing Sunnis come into those countries. When I was in Egypt, I met with somebody at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Egypt who basically said that they didn't want Sunnis to leave Iraq because they didn't want Iraq to become Shia. So they were actively sort of pushing them to stay there, and you know that meant dying, then, you know, that meant dying. As for what academics can do, you know, I think there are severe problems in Lebanon with respect to the laws about migrants and refugees. Obviously, the Palestinians are a very good example of that, but the current Lebanese laws and the current way that the general security is interpreting them is basically putting migrants in prison and waiting for them to crack and decide to return home. It's basically detention or forced return. And there are very active civil society organizations in Lebanon that are trying to fight that. But given the power structures, it's very difficult for them to do that. So any sort of research assistance, any sort of lobbying assistance you can provide to them would be very, very good. There is a very good Human Rights Watch report recently called Rot Here or Die There, about the Iraqis in Lebanon and how they were treated. We also issued some reports about that. And so anything you can do to sort of help those groups and help lobby general security really would be very helpful.
Hi, I'm Steve Chinland. I'm an Episcopal priest, retired, and wonder if there is a plan, or maybe two plans, one for big numbers and one for comparatively small numbers, a multiple of the very, very small numbers you mention anybody's dealing with, a plan for which we could be advocates.
Yes, there are. I mean, thankfully, there have been a lot of congressional initiatives, and you know, some people on the Hill have really taken this as their issue. Senator Kennedy has been extremely active in trying to pass bills on the Senate side. Actually, there was a bill that was passed increasing the number of Iraqi allies, so people who've worked with the U.S. Coming into this country. They're now trying to work on a more substantive bill to sort of improve assistance as well. On the House side, Representative Hastings, Blumenauer, they've all been very active. And there are a lot of bills that are currently on the floor and currently being debated. And I think it would make a world of difference if citizens in this country were calling their congressmen, calling their representatives, and pushing for these bills to be passed. You can find a lot of information about those bills and about these initiatives on many websites, including ours, Refugees International, but I would also refer you to Human Rights First, Human Rights Watch, the International Rescue Committee. All these groups have been very active in pushing those bills, and in many cases we've drafted them. So obviously we're very supportive of them. That's one of the things you can do. Another thing that I think is very essential is resettlement agencies in this country are trying to sensitize communities to the fact that Iraqis do not equal Al-Qaeda. And it's difficult because, frankly, after 8 years of this administration's saying Iraq and Al-Qaeda in every sentence, people have a bad perception of Iraqis. So it's been difficult in certain communities to get Iraqis to be resettled there. So, you know, any sort of awareness raising in your community, and if your families are willing to host an Iraqi or a family who's just arrived in the U.S. who is in bad need of assistance, that's also very well needed. And there are a lot of organizations you can contact. Most of these people speak English, and I mean, really.
It's also really about the only issue I can think of that has bipartisan support on Iraq in Congress. Everything else is divided along partisan lines. And in the country, it has bipartisan support. There are veterans groups of all persuasions. There are churches. There are human rights groups that have taken this as an issue. And I would argue about what our friend from Iraq Veterans Against the War said. I'm glad they're working on this, but I don't think this should be tied to a position on the war, because if it is, it's going to lose. It will be divided along the same lines that the country is divided about the war. This should be considered a separate humanitarian issue, or else it will die of politics. It's already dying of politics as it is, but it will have no chance whatsoever if it's tied to whether you're for staying for 100 years or leaving tomorrow.
Can I add one thing to that? Just on a smaller level, local level, in a place like Amman, for instance, where there are a lot of Christian Iraqi refugees who can't even get medicine, and they're trying to find church groups who will help them. And there are some who go there or who have contacts there, but I mean, I met a woman, both she and her son have cancer, and they couldn't even get their chemo drugs, and you know, they can't work. And this woman who's there, she's a young woman, and she's trying to take care of her mother and her brother. She worked running a coffee machine at the UN, and her life was threatened, and that's why they had to flee.
Yes, sir.
My name is Haider Hamza, and I'm actually from Iraq. I moved here recently. I was able to get here after I got a Fulbright scholarship to finish my postgraduate studies, and I only decided to apply because I wanted to get out, not because I like school, actually. And after I had my share of tragedy over there, I wanted to comment on the security issue that you're talking about, of how it's, for one thing, it is a matter of security, which is true. But on the other hand, I wanted to like point out the situation of the Iraqis who are already in the United States. We're a group of 11 Iraqis who were able to make it. And before coming here, we actually had to sign papers saying that we would never apply for asylum. We're not allowed to get married in the United States. I have an Iraqi woman friend. She got pregnant. She was deported from the country because she got pregnant, because she's not allowed to get pregnant, because she signed saying, I will not get pregnant. That means if she gives the birth, her son will be American, and that will give her right to stay, and they didn't want that. And they could only find out in an eighth month, it was a month before she gave birth, that she was pregnant. She was hiding it all the time. She wasn't even seeing a doctor because she was afraid. And my other friends, when they finished their program, they had to take a bus to Canada and cross the border and rip their passports and say we're refugees. So obviously, the Iraqis are the only ones in that situation from all the Fulbright scholars from around the world. The Fulbright scholars who come from 110 countries, Iraqis are the only ones who go through these laws. We only get one entry visa, meaning we can, but we cannot. We're not allowed to leave, see our families, or visit or anything. Every summer holiday, all the other Fulbright scholars are allowed to go back, see their families, and come again. We're not allowed to leave the country. If we leave, we won't be allowed back for 4 years at least, which means we're going to lose our program. And what's so not. And our families are not allowed to come visit us, not even for our graduation to be present. All the others are allowed to have dependents, like on J2 visa, except Iraqis. And it's kind of like ironic because Iraq is supposed to be like now like a friend. And before the war, it was actually easier for Iraqis than it is now after the war, which is kind of weird. And like all that we've been discussing so far, I guess, a lot of it has been heard, a lot of it has been read. And what I wanted to ask is, like, number one, why no one is doing anything about it here? like I appreciate the turnout here today, but if you look at a country of 300 million people, or even New York City of 8 million people, that's not a fair representation. And I was like, what does it take to actually, like when was the last time when we saw hundreds of thousands demonstrating in the streets? And I want to say the disappointment in Iraq and the betrayal they're feeling is not just about the government alone, but the people as well. People here ask me, like, I here walk around and I ask people if they feel responsible to what's happening, and they say, oh, no, we didn't vote for Bush. We marched against the war. It's not us. It's people in the South and the Midwest, is what I've been told, honestly speaking. And I think it's funny that, I mean, it basically makes them feel better. That way they're not responsible. But I believe that if this is a democracy, as people claim, then every single person here is actually responsible as the other. That's the whole point of democracy. And so I want to ask, like, why no one is doing anything? And what does it take to have people actually move and do something? And what are even organizations, like Open Society or other institutions, like, who are you getting in touch with? Are you in touch with anyone in the government? Are you presenting these issues to them? What do they tell you? Is there hope, or is it just continuous conferences and meetings, and then everyone goes back to their comfortable lives and it's all forgotten? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know who wants to...
You know, some people are working very hard. I mean, Christelle has been doing this month after month for years, and it has had an effect. She and others have moved Congress to pass legislation. That's very hard to do. In a democracy, things move really slowly. People are absorbed in their lives. To expect them to come out on a Thursday night and attend an event on behalf of Iraqi refugees is asking a lot of people. And the fact that people are here tonight in these numbers is encouraging to me, actually. So I don't want to be too hard on the American public. I agree with you. It is all of our responsibility. But you're not going to have 100,000 people marching in the streets. If we wait until then, it will never be solved. The question is, what is the government doing? And I think Christelle and I have given you an answer, which is the government is dragging its feet as much as possible. It is not in the interest of any bureaucrat to let an Iraqi in. It is in their interest, perhaps, to keep an Iraqi out. For that to change requires presidential-level leadership. It will not change without that. I've been encouraged that Hillary Clinton and others have actually talked about this on the campaign trail. They haven't gone into detail. They haven't hammered it home enough that the press has picked up on it or the public has picked up on it. But they know about it, and maybe that will be a sign of some sort of change. I want to say about the Fulbrights, I know several Fulbrights who have applied for asylum and been granted asylum. So it's not as though the entire system is broken and rigged. There are ways, but it's very, very difficult. And it takes either a well-connected backer if you're a refugee or a really good lawyer if you're an asylum candidate. But it is possible. This country has not completely lost touch with its claim to be the place that welcomes the oppressed and poor. But it's in the case of the Iraqis, the hypocrisy level is pretty high.
Just on the asylum point, I mean, please tell your friends, it's illegal to ask anyone to ask for asylum. It's an undeniable human right. Anybody has the right to ask for asylum if their life is in danger. So even if they've signed 11 pieces of papers, they still have a right to ask for asylum, and they will be heard by a court in the United States.
And there are lawyers who are volunteering their time to help people apply for asylum. Mm-hmm. And I do know one who wants to do more, and she actually asked me to ask tonight what she could do. So if you want me to... the other thing is, I think one of the problems of getting people to pay attention to this story is that it's not your typical refugee story of people in a tented camp. Mm-hmm. And it's not visual in that way. And I think by doing pieces like the multimedia piece, and if we could get it traveling around, and I mean, I'm having an exhibition at a gallery on 57th Street right now. A lot of people have been going there, and here don't have any idea what the experience is for Iraqis who've been affected by this war, and they don't know Iraqis, and they don't, you know, they're so ignorant. When the first month of the war, I was assigned on the American hospital ship in the Gulf Sea, and most of the wounded were Iraqis, and these very young core men and women were shocked that we were treating Iraqis. And, you know, it was like, what did they think we were going to Iraq to do, if not help Iraqis? And, you know, they just couldn't get their mind around that. And I just think, you know, the media isn't doing that much. And I think it's either not sexy enough, visually, maybe, in some cases. I mean, George, of course you've written about it. But the stories come and go, and they don't stay around. and there's got to be a way to, you know, even get like these pieces shown and, you know, do more panels like this. I think OSI is going to try to get this piece used in advocacy. I mean, if you could get it to Congress, that would be really good.
Omar, I'd like to bring you in.
Yeah, well, actually, I've heard a lot of Americans here when they're speaking about the war in Iraq. What concerns them is they're always asking that they've been betrayed about the reasons why they send the American troops to Iraq, and whether if Saddam Hussein was connected to Al Qaeda or not, or whether if they like George Bush or not. I want to say that this is like history now. It's 5 years ago, and Americans are already in Iraq, and there is a human tragedy there. I know it makes sense that Americans are more concerned about their sons and daughters who are fighting there, and they are worried about there. But at the same time, there are millions of Iraqis who get caught in the middle in this war. They were looking for freedom and democracy, and there were a lot of promises that they've heard before the war, and they hope that these things will improve in Iraq. But instead, now they are they are scared on their life. And what's really bothering me is my government, Iraqi government. I mean, it's corrupted to a very, very high degree, and it's got infiltrated by militias and by influences from outside the country, and they are increasingly they are participating in a huge way in making Iraqis' life like hell. And really, I feel angry when I see the American government, the American administration supporting the Iraqi government, and they saying that they will do everything to support this government and keep them functioning. So I just want, like, when you are the, like, American people here, from your position, I want you just to talk about that to other people, just to educate them about the human tragedy, the people suffers, the people are crying, they don't know what to do. And also to realize that if something wrong happened here, it could be like on individual basis. I mean, unfortunately, like, Iraqis considered terrorists to some degree. Like in Jordan, they stopped letting Iraqis enter after three Iraqis exploded themselves in Amman Hotel. While they forget it was coordinated by a Jordanian, Zarqawi. It was a Jordanian born, and there were tribes in Jordan who made funeral for Zarqawi when he was killed. So Iraqis are not terrorists. Iraqis are simple people who get caught in a war, and they lost everything. They lost their houses, they lost their belonging. I mean, for example, my family, they left Iraq with their clothes only. Myself, I left everything back at home, and I don't think I'll see my things again, like my pictures, for example, or my other belongings that I care for or I collected the whole my life. I've lost my friends, a lot of my friends. I never seen them. So I'm hoping really there will be some change, like if you go and you speak to people and you educate them about this increasing problem.
I mean, I think the Open Society Institute clearly has tried to take what role it can. Obviously, you know, the other side is, as I think George is pointing out, is likely to see that if one part of the political spectrum will politicize this issue, then they're going to run away from it. But clearly, this is something that all Americans have to rally around, and we've been trying to do modestly what part we can. I wanted to pick up on something that Omar said, because, you know, I think that the government of Iraq, which is in a sense, there's a vacuum here, because this is should be the group of people who are leading this country, who can be the tribune for the tragedy that is befalling the nation. And they should be, if you will, shaming the U.S. government and encouraging the international community. it would be especially helpful, you know, if the Iraqi government, which has also made pledges, financial pledges, to help out the neighboring governments. It's not that Iraq doesn't have the money, and it's maybe just a temporary matter. They pledged $25 million.
They finally paid them.
They finally paid.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. And, of course, I mean, it's understood that who's responsible in the bigger picture, that there is this government and that there is this crisis. And it's hoped that maybe in the space that's been created in Baghdad now that they can speak out more on this issue. But we're going to remain seized of this and continue to create opportunities for the type of very difficult stories to be told and present the types of solutions that Christelle and George and Omar and Lori are bringing to your attention. So I'd like to continue.
Hi, my name's Cami and I'm a John Gardner Fellow in Public Service. Thank you very much to the speakers and to the audience members that have come before me. I know the focus so far has been primarily on the U.S. and Iraq, but I wanted to push the discussion a little bit more on the multilateral side. UNHCR was mentioned a couple of times by some of the speakers, and I wanted to learn more about what they are doing and in what capacity can we try to push that multilateral agenda, given that our current administration is not the most encouraging one. And then turning back to the U.S., maybe this is a little presumptuous of me, but from what I've seen of how the Bush administration has been able to sort of get moving and off its feet on certain controversial issues like Darfur and climate change, it seems like a key constituent to tap into is the evangelicals. And I wanted to know, I mean, obviously the Iraqi war veterans are a really great constituency to tap into, but has there been any reaching out done to, for example, a National Association of Evangelicals, which has a huge presence in D.C. and has a key lobbyist who works the congressional halls daily as his job? If that's an area that's been explored, or maybe reasons why that shouldn't be explored, those are my two comments. Thanks.
On the multilateral front, and the UN response in particular, a lot of progress has been achieved in the past couple of years. I was in Syria in November 2006, and at the time there were about 700,000 Iraqi refugees. There's a double now, but UNHCR had a very small office in Damascus, and I met with the head of mission there, and he was desperate. I mean, they were trying to sound, you know, to ring the bell and to say there's a crisis looming, people are arriving. We're seeing 40,000 people a month arriving since February 2006, the Samarra bombing. There's no help. The Syrian government doesn't have the means to assist, etc. And the international community was not responding. And in November 2006, for 700,000 Iraqi refugees in Syria, UNHCR Syria had a budget of $600,000, so less than a dollar per Iraqi, which obviously meant that they couldn't do much. It was the same in Jordan, same in Lebanon, same in Egypt. Thankfully, with all the naming and shaming that a lot of civil society organizations and media outlets have engaged in with respect to this crisis, the UN was able to take a much stronger role, and the budgets have been multiplied by 10 now, basically. The UNHCR operation in Syria, to give you an example, went from $600,000 to about, now it's about $60 million just for Syria. So in the course of 2 years, it's significant. And it's also very difficult for the UN to increase that significantly in the course of 2 years. I mean, the UN... I like the UN, but my God, the bureaucracy, the slowness, the whole process, it's been very difficult. And frankly, in that particular crisis, with respect to the regional response, they've been doing much better than they were expected to do, especially UNHCR. Other UN agencies were very slow to respond. They have a development focus. They're there to assist the governments, not the people. They don't implement programs. And frankly, a lot of their budgets came from the U.S., and there was a reluctance to sort of tell the U.S. donor, you know what, there's a humanitarian crisis, and you know what, you kind of caused it, so give us money. So, I mean, it was very sensitive, and finally it came to a point where the budgets are flowing. There are currently a lot of appeals that are unmet. To give you an example, the World Health Organization issued an appeal for, I think, $160 million regionally, and I think until a month ago they had received $2 million. So, I mean, there's still a lot to be done on that, but at least the UN is sort of increasing. Inside Iraq is another issue. The UN there has a bad reputation for many reasons, linked to the sanctions during the Saddam Hussein era, unable to stop the war in 2003, unable to deploy on its own since 2003, linked to the multinational forces, etc. So it's very difficult for the UN to really take a strong humanitarian role in Iraq, especially since its mandate is very, very political. They're there to support the government, that very government that oppresses its own people, that, you know, obviously favors Shia versus Sunnis in many areas, that has been infiltrated by militias. So it's an impossible situation for the UN right now. Just another word on multilateral. I've been to many embassies and many capitals in Europe and in the Arab world and in New York and in Geneva and told many international donors this is not just a U.S. issue anymore, it's an international issue. In 2007, Iraqis were the highest group of asylum seekers in Europe. It is likely to continue to grow like that. It's also your problem, you want to help. And basically the response we've gotten every time was, it's not our mess, we don't have to clean it, and until we see significant leadership from the United States, and by significant leadership, we don't mean $20 million, we mean significant leadership, we're not going to react. And that's, you know, we've been emphasizing this over and over again in Washington, and it just isn't heard. Because the feeling in Washington is if they take a leadership role in responding, it means they're acknowledging they have a specific responsibility, and they don't want to do that.
You know, it's a very good question about the churches. I know that some have been involved locally in helping refugees settle here, et cetera, but as a constituency, I don't know if they've been brought in. I don't know if they want to be brought in, but I think it's a very astute question, and advocates should think about it hard.
Sir.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Sławomir Greenberg. I'm a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, also a media justice fellow from years ago here at SOAS. I'm working on a documentary about Iraqi translators, a story which is part of the big picture of Iraqi refugees. I went to Amman, I went to Zarqa with my colleague who is a photographer. We spent a lot of time and we found that the most tragic stories out of many, many tragic stories are the stories of translators and those who help American army. There is a special program, nobody mentioned here at the panel, that there is a special visa program for translators which accepts 2,500 a year, started from 500, now 2,500 a year from Iraq. This is a very interesting phenomenon, and the way the translators are treated when they come to this country is very different than any other refugees. I'm following a story of three of those translators. Two of them are in the U.S. Actually, three of them are in the U.S. One of them I started in Amman, and then there are two more who are in Iraq. And the way they have to go through in order to get here, the expenses and the way they are treated is very different than anything else what any other refugees experience. Maybe anybody from the panel can mention that group. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think what you're referring to is a special program of special immigrant visas for former translators, yes, from Iraq and from Afghanistan. And until the Kennedy bill, basically, that I mentioned earlier, there were only 50 a year that were admitted into this country, and there was a backlog of 7 years, basically. So it was extremely difficult to get in, and now the numbers have increased. But it's not a refugee resettlement program, it's a special immigrant visa program, and the difference is that those people are given visas, but then they're left on their own with paying for the travel expenses, getting their families in, etc. So I can't tell you the number of emails I have from people stuck in Damascus and Amman saying, how do I come up with the $10,000 that I need to bring my family to the United States? Now, there's a proposal in front of Congress lobbied by refugee agencies. Refugee Council USA has taken the lead on this, basically arguing for special immigrant visas to have the same benefits as refugees. So hopefully, if it's not vetoed by the president, and I wouldn't put it past him not to veto it, we never know, it's gonna happen, and those people are gonna have their expenses paid for. But I just want to say a word about the former translators. I think a lot of emphasis has been put on this group, and rightfully so. These people are targeted. So are former cooks and drivers and cleaners, and these people we don't really hear about because it seems less important, less glamorous, but they're equally targeted. And so are countless of other Iraqis who maybe have not directly worked for the U.S. but have either believed in the U.S. enterprise or simply lived their lives, you know, and now have to cope with the result of that U.S. enterprise. So I understand, and I think it's important to have a special program for those who have worked for the U.S., but I think the number of slots we allocate for these people should not be taken from the larger group, because the obligation is towards all vulnerable refugees and not just former employees. I am extremely reluctant to create a group of good refugees versus bad refugees. I think all refugees are good, and there should be objective criteria of vulnerability. And that's what the UN is trying to do. They have 11 criteria of vulnerability. You have former employees, you have, you know, women-headed households, unaccompanied minors, people who have been tortured, etc., etc. And this is how we try to assess if somebody is in immediate need of refugee resettlement. If parallel to that, the U.S. wants to have its own program for its own people, great. But let us not take away from the larger group of people who should not be, you know, put aside just because they weren't direct hires of the U.S. government.
I disagree a little, Christelle. You're absolutely right that all civilians who are at risk have a claim on us. But I think it's a kind of ordinary human feeling that people who actually came under your protection and who have been abandoned have both a moral claim and also a political claim. And if this is an issue of 2 million Iraqi refugees, it's a statistic. If this is an issue of particular people who did put themselves under our protection and allied with us, then it's a human story. Not to push the statistic aside, but to make people care about it. Politically, this has to be front and center, or else Congress and presidential candidates won't even touch it. I think it may be unfair that it's that way, but that's a political reality. So I don't apologize or wish away the fact that there are particular groups like Kirk Johnson's The List Project and some law firms who are involved, particularly in Iraqis who work with us. I think it's the only way to get the American public to take the entire refugee issue seriously, because it's just a basic human connection to feel responsible for these particular Iraqis, and then through them, to understand the stories of other Iraqis. But otherwise, those other stories would have long since been forgotten, I think.
I just want to add one thing. There are a lot of Iraqis indirectly work for the foreigners, mm-hmm. because they had no other way to get a job. So one guy was a carpenter's, you know, his boss started working for the British, or somebody was bringing stuff to the U.S. bases that the soldiers couldn't get, so he's helping to supply them with things, or even volunteering, and somebody's helping him. And all those people are affected too, and they don't have any protection. You know, the thing about there are people who are not translators who have gotten the SIV visa. You know, I know a driver who's here on that. But also, it is very difficult for all these refugees who are coming here to find jobs. And even that, I know a translator who came here. He worked for one of the largest media outlets. And he applied for a job with the government, and because he's not a naturalized citizen, he can't get a job doing that. But he did that in Iraq. So
I mean, the ironies are too many, but I know of another case of an Iraqi who worked with a media organization and spent about a year and a half languishing in Damascus and finally arrived here. And within a few days of his arrival, was invited to interview for a job working in the Green Zone for the U.S. government, which would have paid him maybe 30 times or 40 times what he could ever have made in Iraq working for Americans, but which required him to stay inside the green zone. So he couldn't go out and see his family. So we're not willing to protect them while they're Iraqis in Iraq who happen to work for us. But once they get here, we'll pay them a hell of a lot of money and send them back there as long as they stay in the green zone, which means they're not really going to be functioning very well as Iraqis. So there's something wrong with this this whole system.
I know some who've taken those jobs.
Indeed.
Actually.
Yeah. Omar, do you have any concluding comments?
Well, I'm hoping that with these meetings and with all the efforts that things will change on the ground, because there are a lot of people who are waiting, millions of people waiting for their situations to change, to have only a decent life. They are not asking for so much. They just want to live peacefully and have a decent life that every human being deserves to live. And I just want to thank you very much for coming, and thanks for the OSI for giving me this chance to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So just to recap on things that you can do, go see and encourage your friends to see Lori's exhibit at the Nelia Alexander Gallery. There's information about that here. See and urge your friends to watch Omar's documentary on HBO on January 29th. See and recommend your friends to get tickets to George's play Betrayed at the Culture Project. And Christelle and Refugees International have a number of policy ideas. You should visit their website and those of the other groups that are taking this question up, and make, as George said, make this an issue that is debated and to which candidates for office this year must go on the record with their views and their commitments, and there are many proposals. We can't tell you what to do with them, but you should make your opinions known to your elected representatives. So I want to thank the candor and the efforts of all of those on the panel, and thank the audience for your support, because through that support, our commitment has been strengthened, and will not rest until we get a good answer on this. Thank you all.